Good afternoon, America. Welcome to Mark Levine's Inside Scoop, where we bring you all the news from Washington, D.C. that the government does not want you to know. And while the government and all of official Washington is focused today on the funeral of Ronald Reagan, he's lying in state here in Washington in the Capitol Dome. He'll arrive soon, and all traffic shut down, and federal workers have taken off their jobs because the presidential hearse has taken over the streets. And all this focus on Ronald Reagan, and we've done our focus. I mean, we did a few shows on it this week. Very little focus is made over the most popular president not to die in office. That would be Bill Clinton. If you look at the Gallup polls for presidents at the end of their time in office, the two most popular, of course, are the two presidents who died in office, Franklin Delano Roosevelt and John F. Kennedy. But if you look at the presidents who did not die in office, Ronald Reagan is pretty high up there. He had a 63% approval rating when he left office. The only president to beat him, since Gallup polls have been around in the post-war period, is William Jefferson Clinton. Yes, President Bill Clinton had a 66% approval rating when he left office. And he's about to go on a big book tour, talking about his book, My Life, a 900-some-page book that goes into lots of details of his childhood all the way up to the presidency. And I'm going to be playing for you today, unedited, a speech by Bill Clinton that lasts about 45 minutes, where he talks about his book, My Life. And I, you know, part of what we try to do here on the Inside Scoop, it's really not about hearing myself talk. That's not what it's about. It's about conveying information. And sometimes I feel I'm the best to convey that information. Sometimes I feel it's best if I put on a guest. Sometimes I feel it's best if I'm arguing with someone who disagrees. But sometimes we just got to take a back seat and let the master do his work. Al Gore was on, he wasn't on my program, but we played the speech, the full speech of Al Gore a few weeks ago. And now I want to play the full speech of Bill Clinton. It is unedited. I will not interrupt until the end, at which point I will make a comment and also take your calls. So you're welcome to call in if you want, we will not take your calls until the very end of the hour. If you want to call in, the number is 877-57-SCOOP, 877-57-SCOOP, or you can send an email to comment@radioinsidescoop.com. Here on the Inside Scoop, we like to be first. We know that Bill Clinton's about to go on a book tour, but I want you to hear first the words of the person I believe was the greatest president in my lifetime. Listen as you listen to the speech and how Bill Clinton talks about American values that bring us together rather than split us apart. How he talks about the ways America brings us together as a people, not separating into poor and rich or white or black. And think what a difference this president, Bill Clinton's optimism, his knowledge, his brilliance, how he talks about history. Think about how different that is from the current resident in the White House. Ladies and gentlemen, I present to you the 42nd president of the United States, as I said, the best president in my lifetime, William Jefferson Clinton.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you. Wow. You have to be careful treating me that way. You'll have me thinking I'm president again. Thank you for the invitation to appear. And I want to thank Sonny Mehta for that really wonderful introduction and for believing in this project and agreeing to publish My Life. I've found it quite an honor to get to know Sonny and all the people at Knopf, although he wasn't always as upbeat as he was to you today. Back when all the gossip writers in New York were saying, oh, Clinton's going to 20 countries this year and 30 next, and will he ever do this book, you know? From time to time, when I was working like crazy on this book, I would see Sonny, and he would give me that look. Like one time, about a year ago maybe, a little less, I went to have lunch. in New York with one of my college roommates and a friend of his who became a friend of mine who became the Republican governor of Arizona when we grew up. And we were sitting there, and Sonny saw me at this restaurant, and I got that look. And the look was, why did I pay you all this money if you're going to take time to have lunch? And how dare you take the time to drive from Chappaqua to New York City to have lunch? But eventually we got it done, and it was a wonderful experience. I want to thank the Knopf team, many of whom are here, Kathy Horgan, Andy Hughes, Paul Bogarts, have been so helpful to prepare the launch of this book, and everyone who has been involved. There's a ton of folks back in New York who've really helped us a lot. My lawyer, Bob Barnett, here, who introduced me to Knopf and helped me negotiate with a lot of foreign publishers who will publish the book. So far, only one of them has asked for pictures only of that country. I want to thank Greg Topalian and all the people at Book Expo America for inviting me here. And I'd also like to acknowledge three people who were essential to the completion of the book, who came with me today. Justin Cooper essentially made it possible for me to do this book when I did. I wrote it longhand in 20-something notebooks, and he put it in the computer, printed it out, and then we chiseled on it five or six other times, each section, and he did the basic research. And then Meg Thompson and Caitlin Kovorek did all the fact-checking. If there are still factual errors in it, it's not their fault, and they certainly tried. But when you write as much as I did, it's almost impossible not to make a mistake somewhere. I want to thank the Booksellers of America for agreeing to have this book, My Life in Your Lives, for the next few months, and for all you do to promote reading. I'm a great book lover. You can hardly navigate my house for all the books that are stacked everywhere, and I can't build any more bookshelves in the house, I don't think. When I left the White House, we sent 4,000 books home to Arkansas to the library and took 1,000 or so to Washington, where my senator lives during the week and where I get to visit on occasion. And we bought a couple of thousand home, and I think we've acquired another 1,000 since then. People are good enough to send me their books in galley copies and when they come out. And so between the ones I buy and the ones that are given to me, I can hardly walk around without stumbling over them. But I have had a lifelong love affair with reading since my grandmother gave me Dick and Jane readers when I was literally 2 and 3 years old. And I used to hang out at the local public library when I was in grade school and read about the Indian chiefs I most admired. I still remember I still have a paper I did in elementary school on Native Americans, and referencing these books I'd read about Sitting Bull and Crazy Horse and Osceola, the great Florida chief who developed the first alphabet for his people. So I've always loved reading. And books have had a big impact on my life. And as you'll see in the book, I mention a lot of the books that have meant a lot to me in the course of my life, as well as a lot of my teachers. Most of them survived the editorial cut. Although Robert Gottlieb, my editor, was a joy to work with and one of the most interesting experiences of my life. He had worked with Robert Caro, with Joseph Heller, with Catherine Graham, with Katharine Hepburn, with Lauren Bacall, a lot of interesting people. He knew something about everything, but not so much about politics, and he didn't really think he wanted to know very much about it. So I sent him the first 150 pages, and Gottlieb called me. First thing, we had this meeting, and I told him what I was going to do, and he said, well, we may do it that way, but you're working for me now. And I hadn't worked for anybody in a long time, so it was interesting. But I sent him 150 pages or so, triple-spaced, and he said, this is a really good story, but let me ask you something. Are you running for anything anymore? I said, no, I'm done. He said, good, you cannot put the name of every person you ever met in this book. And he said, I do not care what happened to their children and grandchildren. And it bothers me that my president had room left enough in his head to remember what happened to the children and grandchildren, the very person he ever met. And so I said, look, Gottlieb, I'm from Arkansas. That's what we do. That's what we care about. I mean, you know, I can't help it. That's who we are. So, see, we got some book readers out there from home, too. So then I sent him another 100 pages or so on the American South in the late 40s and 50s. And he called in my childhood. So he called and said, I really like this. But he said, I said, well, you got any questions? He said, just one. I said, what is it? He said, did you know any sane people as a child? I said, no, but neither did anybody else. I was just paying more attention than most people. So then I sent him 150 pages or so on my introduction to Arkansas politics and my exposure to different kinds of people in the 70s and early 80s. And he said, boy, this is really good. How much of it did you make up? He said, this is a story. You can't make stuff up here. You got to tell the truth. I said, so help me God. This is all these things happen. So he said, well, when people read this, they'll all want to go to Arkansas because it's much more like a novel by Gabriel Garcia Marquez than a politician's memoir. So I had a very interesting run-through. And then when Gottlieb would try to get me to cut things, Justin and I began to play games with him. And I sent him one draft, which just said out of the blue in the middle of a paragraph. And not only that, Robert Gottlieb's the greatest editor in human history. And he cut it. But he put that he did it reluctantly. But I found out, you know, if I tried to say too much about movies or football or the rock and roll culture in which I grew up, that stuff was all, you know, I wanted to write a whole page on High Noon, my favorite movie, and why it's an important movie. It really is a very important movie in American history. And you know, if you're nice to me, I'll somehow give you what Gottlieb asked me to cut out of it. But so I started playing games with his New York sensibility. And I quoted Yeats three times before he finally cut one. I wanted to talk about how I made a trip to Limerick on one of my last stops in Ireland. There were 50,000 people in the street and how wonderful it was. And I was afraid that he thought I had too much Ireland in the book. So I told him when I was in Limerick that Frank McCourt was a friend of mine, and I loved Angela's Ashes, but I liked the new Limerick better than the old one, survived the cut. So once I figured out the cultural taste of my editor, I just kept ballooning the book. You know, and it was really interesting. I'd never done anything like this before, and I'm sure that many of you have. I just want to make a couple of comments about it. First of all, most of you in this audience are younger than me. Most everybody is now. But I really think anybody who's fortunate enough to live to be 50 years old should take some time, maybe just a couple of weekends, and sit down and write the story of your life, even if it's only 20 pages, and even if it's only for your children, your grandchildren, and your closest friends. Young people today have access to more information than any group of people in human history. They learn how to use the internet for good or ill at early ages. They see 60, 70 or more channels on television if they have satellite. But they still hunger to know about their roots. They don't want to be full of facts and information and uprooted from their past. And one of the most amazing experiences for me in writing this book was seeing it through my daughter's eyes. And I've been talking to her about all this stuff for her whole life, but she still learns some things about her family and people in her family that she didn't know. She was also very helpful to me. She was one of my best readers because she'd say, Dad, this thing you said about the 50s, you said it in shorthand. I know what you mean because you told me, but you got to unpack it. You got to put another sentence or two in here because people my age won't know what in the living daylights you're talking about if you don't. But I highly recommend it to all of you because you can't imagine what it would mean to your children. Second thing, observation I would have is that it's very therapeutic because I found myself thinking about this book in like sections. You know, I'm writing about these 3 or 4 years now, that 3 or 4 years then. And when I would get into any particular part of my life, after about an hour, I was there again. And I know your memory plays tricks on you over the years, but I really felt, I believe, as I did when I was 5 years old and my stepfather in a drunken rage shot a gun in our house. And the bullet landed in a wall between where my mother and I were standing. And I could almost feel it again. And it happened to me again when I was president. Things I thought I wasn't mad about anymore, I got mad about all over again. One day I was writing about what Kenneth Starr did to Susan McDougal. I got so mad I couldn't work for 4 hours. I never had any writer's block. But I did have these emotional just waves coming over me. A lot of happiness, too. So if this book's no good, it's all my fault. If it is good, the people whose names I mentioned deserve a lot of credit. But I just tried to tell a story. And I feel that I was very fortunate in my political career in having grown up in the last pre-television age. I was almost 10 years old when we got a television the first time. And all my people were working people from Arkansas. And at the end of World War II, the per capita income of my state was only 56% of the national average. Only Mississippi at 48% was poorer then. But since nobody had any money to speak of, no one felt poor as long as they had clothes on their back and they were clean and they had a place to sleep at night and they had enough food to feed whoever walked in the front door. And most of our entertainment when I was a child centered around meals and storytelling. Before you could tell one, you had to listen to one. You had to learn to listen and learn to appreciate the kind of unique characteristics of superficially ordinary people. And I feel profoundly indebted to all my family. My grandmother, who was a nurse, and her sister, who was a nurse, and my great uncle, Buddy, who was probably the most important member of my extended family, who was a farmer, a fireman, did a lot of other things, and who had one of his lungs taken out in 1974 for lung cancer, survived it and lived to be 91. They were great storytellers. And they were really smart. And back then, this is one thing poor white people and black people in the South shared in common. The person that was pumping your gas at the local filling station might be just as smart as the person taking your tonsils out at the hospital. Because there was no such thing as universal educational opportunity. It was largely by accident of birth and circumstance. They were all pre-GI Bill folks. And it made for an amazing childhood of people who made the ordinary extraordinary. And my uncle never got over telling stories. When he was in his late 80s, not long, 3 or 4 years before he died, I was talking to him. And he was bragging on the fact that his wife had been dead then for several years, and he was bragging on the fact that even though he hadn't had but one lung in forever and a day, he was still alert enough to drive his car, and he took two ladies out for rides every week. One was 91 and the other was 93. So I said, you like these older women now? And he looked at me. He didn't miss a beat. He said, you know, I do. It seems like they're a little more settled. So I had an inordinate advantage when I went into politics because I liked people and I'd learned to listen to their stories. I also had a great advantage because I lived with my grandparents till I was 4, and until I was 6, I spent massive amounts of time with them. And they were unusual characters for a small southern town. They were uneducated, relatively, white folks of modest means who didn't have a racist bone in their body. And I learned a lot, particularly from my grandfather, about looking up to people other folks looked down on. And he's one of the people I dedicated my book to. But a lot of the good things that happened to me in life, I don't deserve any credit for at all. They were things that were put into me when I was very, very young. It has nothing to do with anything good about me. I just learned from what I saw. And the power of their example was considerable. Now, what I tried to do in this book was essentially, I tried to accomplish two things, and it's really, you could almost look at it as two separate books. From my birth through the election of 1992, I tried to tell a story. I tried to tell a story of my life and the story of America and how my small life interwove with America's life, beginning with the South at the end of World War II and through the 50s, and my trip to Georgetown to college and to Yale to law school and to Oxford to study, and then back through my political career. I try to explain what happened in America, and with particular care what happened in the 1960s and how America broke open politically in all the turmoil of 1968. With the deaths of Robert Kennedy and Martin Luther King and the controversy over the Vietnam War, the rise of the women's movement, and all the things that happened, and the beginning of the polarization of politics, part of which occurred here in Chicago at the Democratic Convention, and how Republicans became Republicans and Democrats became Democrats, and there was a lot of shift in chairs, why the white Southerners who had been conservative Democrats became Republicans. And basically, I reached the conclusion a long time ago, which I say in the book, that if you look back on the 60s and on balance, you think there was more good than harm in it, you're probably a Democrat. And if you think there's more harm than good, you're probably a Republican. And there were excesses and self-indulgences of the 60s. And all that stuff people say that's critical of me and my generation, there's some truth in all of it. But it was also a profoundly idealistic generation of people who loved their country and believed it could be better. And so I try to tell this story. The second part of the book, which begins on the day after the election with the transition and goes until I leave the White House, is almost like a diary of the presidency. And there is a lot of policy in it. Some will think too much. But I think it's important because the presidency is a deciding job. You hire presidents to make decisions. They not only decide which decisions to make, but which ones to consider. And I had the great good fortune and challenge to live at one of the great turning points of American history, not only the end of the Cold War, but the end of the Industrial Age, the dawn of a global information age of total interdependence around the world. And there were a lot of decisions to be made. And so while this is not a serious policy book, and a lot of these autobiographies you read, there's a chapter on foreign policy and a chapter on this country or that country, or a chapter on domestic policy or on economics or education. It's none of that here. It all comes together. I take a few pages to explain something when I come across it, like Bosnia, so people have enough background to follow the story. But essentially, I do this. I tell you the story as it happened to me, because I want people to understand what it is like to be president, or at least what it was like for me to do the job, and to see how everything happens at once, and see how you come to office with a set of commitments that you try to keep, but you also have to deal with the incoming mail, all the things that happen you didn't imagine would happen. And you have to deal with the political opposition and what you can do and what you can't. You have to make judgments about how much change the system can absorb if you're a change agent. And I try to describe that in ways so that you'll at least see how it looked to me. You know, a lot of presidential memoirs, they say, are dull and self-serving. I hope mine is interesting and self-serving. But I don't try to settle a lot of scores here. I don't agree with the great temptations of modern politics to think these massive divisions that exist, these ideological divisions in our country, mean that some people are good people and some are bad. I'm not interested in arguing who's good or bad. I'm interested in arguing who's right or wrong for America, for the world, and for our children's future. And so I try to explain from my point of view what my opponents believed and why. How the Republican Party changed at the end of the Cold War, or really started in the 70s in reaction to what happened in the 60s, and then with the election of President Reagan accelerated. and how the definition of conservative Republican today is very different than it was 20 years ago. When I was governor, my vote went up every year among Republicans because I was pro-business as well as pro-labor, because I was a fiscal conservative, because they believed that not all taxes were bad, especially if they went for education and you improved education, because I was for safe streets and welfare reform. And it always went up. When I became president, I found myself isolated from most of the Republicans because they thought deficits were good because there's no such thing as a good tax. And they had a whole different theory about that. They had a whole different theory, but Barry Goldwater was a libertarian who supported my position on gays in the military. But he was completely isolated by 1993 because of the influence of the religious right in America on the Washington Republican Party. And I try to explain how that looked from their point of view and why they believe that our national community should be defined by people who share the same values, have the same ideas, and make sure they're imposed, and why that led them to believe that the most important thing was to make sure the right people were in power and to concentrate as much power in their hands as possible. I am from, I think, a more traditional American position going all the way back to the founders, which is that politics is not religion and we should govern on the basis of evidence, not theology. And that it's a great experiment. But what's going on today has happened before in America, and it should be no particular cause for concern for you. Because, and I'll tell you why. Throughout history, the partisan battles have always been most intense when we reached a turning point in history and we had to reimagine our country and we had to redefine the terms of our union. What did our founders mean when they said, let's form a more perfect union? That was the permanent mission they gave us, right? I think that was both a humble and a daring statement. It was humble, and in this sense, we're more modest in a way than the new right, because our founders said, we will never be perfect, but we can always be more perfect than we are. And we had great turning. We had huge partisan fights as soon as George Washington cleared out, beginning in his second term, because we never defined what America was except a bunch of people that didn't want to be ruled by the English and did want to be led by George Washington. We hadn't decided whether to have a national economy. We hadn't decided whether to have a national legal system. The heirs of Washington, Alexander Hamilton and John Marshall, said yes. Thomas Jefferson said no. Thank God Thomas Jefferson lost that fight. And then when he got to be president, Jefferson liked this whole national union quite well. He spent the equivalent of a year's budget buying Louisiana and doubling the size of America. He sent Lewis and Clark out. In his second term, he imposed an embargo, which had vastly unequal impacts on the states. But once we resolved that, we had a period of remarkable political stability until 1840, when the country was then faced with another challenge to the Union. What are we going to do about slavery? Are we going to let it expand or not? And when people got mad about people trying to contain slavery, they threatened to withdraw from the Union. Abraham Lincoln was elected on a promise to preserve the Union and not to abolish slavery. A lot of people have forgotten this, but to contain it. Then the war came and slavery was abolished in the southern states. Then afterward we had Reconstruction, the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments. We fought about this from 1840 to 1868, and it was tough. One Illinois newspaper, when Abraham Lincoln was elected, called him a baboon, said we'd be better off if he were assassinated. I mean, there's nothing new about a lot of this stuff. Then President Grant was elected, and between 1868 and 1900, we had four Union generals from Ohio. You had a 50% chance of being elected president if you were a Union general from Ohio. I mean, it was like, you know, there's no ticket to the White House like that today. But it bespoke a certain... Now, we had partisan fights. Grover Cleveland served two terms, one interrupted. Had a slightly different view But there was a consensus within which the debate occurred. So we survived our second big challenge. Then we faced our third big challenge when we became an industrial country rather than an agricultural country and had all these new immigrants coming to us and were pulled into the world, at least economically. So then the question was, well, what do we do about these large economic units that dominate our lives and create all these factory jobs but are causing a heck of a lot of problems? And the answer was, the issue was, do we have to have a big government to stand against big industry to do three things: promote competition, preserve decency in the workplace, and keep our natural resources from being completely plundered? Theodore Roosevelt said yes. William Howard Taft said no. Then Woodrow Wilson said yes. And the greatest partisan shift in our country's history in that four-year period, the Democrats went from being the conservative party, which they had been since from before the Civil War to 1912, to being the liberal party in America, the more liberal party, the slightly left of center party as opposed to the slightly right of center party. And we fought about the terms of our union as against the industrial era and our relationships with the world all the way until the end of World War II, when we went into the United Nations, which we had not done after World War I. So we had a period of upheaval. Now, we had more unity when Roosevelt got elected because of the war. But we resolved those questions. Then we had 45 more years, or 40 more years of more or less cohesive thought from World War II until 1980 or so. President Reagan was the first sort of post-industrial president, and in a way a post-Cold War president, because even though the Berlin Wall hadn't fallen, nobody thought there'd be a nuclear war by then. So Reagan says, the government is the problem, except for defense. And we tried it, and so the new Republican Party was, by then, represented all these forces that you know about today. Then we tried it their way for 12 years, and we quadrupled the debt, and we had a lot of other problems. And so I got elected in 92 saying, we have a new democratic approach. We're not just going to preserve the gains of the past. We have a new economic policy, a new social policy that favors work and family over welfare and dependence. We have a crime policy. We have a foreign policy. Here's what we're going to do. We tried it our way for 8 years. Then in 2000, it looked for a moment as if there might be an emerging bipartisan consensus when at the end of the election, Al Gore was running on don't put the prosperity at risk, and George Bush was running on compassionate conservative, which is a nice way of saying, I'll give you what they did with a smaller government, a bigger tax cut. Wouldn't you like that? But see, it was a fight within range, if you see what I mean. Then an emerging consensus. But the new Republican Party was far to the right of that. And so that's not what's happened, particularly after 9/11, when our unity was taken for weakness and there was a big attempt to push us way to the right. So their foreign policy is more unilateralist than mine was. And my view was we should act together whenever we can and act on our own if we have to. Their view was different. It was act on our own whenever we can and cooperate when it's in our interest to do so. And there's a very significant difference in the particulars there. And the same thing is true about domestic policy. But what I want you to understand is it's because we are in a fundamentally different era. And this is a story I tried to tell along with my personal story. And every time America has gone through one of these periods of upheaval, the partisanship, the struggle for power, the personal nature of attacks has intensified. The stuff I went through has its closest parallel in the early days of the Republic. Go back and look at what Adams people said about Thomas Jefferson in 1796 when they were running for president. It would blister the hairs off a dog's back. And so you shouldn't worry about this. This is a great... Every time we've had a chance to do it, we have always chosen the union. We've chosen to widen the circle of opportunity, to deepen the meaning of freedom, strengthen the bonds of our community. And we started to fray. We absorbed the civil rights movement and the women's rights movement, Roe v. Wade and all that, and had a big reaction starting in the mid-60s, going all the way to the end, until the Reagan revolution. But the main thing that made it possible for those folks to get in power was the fundamental nature of our relationships changed, the way we work, the way we live, the way we relate to the government, the way we relate to each other and the rest of the world, all changed. And so we're just in this period when we're trying to figure it out. As you might imagine, in my book, I say I think my side will win because it works better. It's the only alternative. We've always chosen to become a more unified country and a more inclusive country and to reach out to the world more, with the single exception of the end of World War I, where we withdrew from the world with hideous consequences. So I'm optimistic about all this. And what I tried to do with this book was to always tell my life story, my family story, how Hillary and I met, what we did, what we tried to do in public life, how we tried to raise our daughter, what was everybody. There's a lot of personal stuff, even in the White House years. But I tried to show how this one little story was part of America's big story. So that I hope when you finish the book, you will think that you learn not just more about me, but also about your country, about the history of your country, the potential of your country, the way politics works, the way the economy works, and the foreign policy challenges we face. I don't spare myself in this book. I take on a lot of water for not just the personal, but also the political errors I think I made, and I try to explain what they were and how they came to be. And I don't settle a lot of scores in this book. I think you'll find my relationship with Newt Gingrich, for example, quite interesting. And you'll see that I like Bob Dole a lot, and I like my predecessor, President Bush, a lot, and that we had these honest disagreements and what they were and what the fights were. You'll see why Kenneth Starr really believed it was okay to apply a different set of rules to me and all the people that knew me and all the people from Arkansas than he applied to everybody else. And why the Congress thought it was all right to apply a different set of rules to me than they applied to Newt Gingrich. And why they believed they were right. And that's important. I'm not supposed to tell any stories from the book, and I already told one, but I'm going to tell you one more because it had a big impact on me. When I was 13, I had a science teacher named Vernon Doakey. That was almost 55 years ago, in the eighth grade. And Vernon Doakey had a wife named Verna who taught history, and a sister-in-law named Vera who taught me geometry and algebra. Verna, Vera, and Vernon. Now, the ladies were fine-looking women. They looked like sisters. They were really attractive ladies in early middle age. To put it charitably, Vernon Doakey was not a fine-looking fellow. He was chunky. He was big around the waist. He was burly. He wore a Coke bottle, glasses. He had a kind of a hawk-beak nose. And he smoked cheap cigars in a plastic cigar holder, which gave his mouth a real pinched look. And he knew it. I mean, nobody's fool. So one day we were in class, and he said, "Kids, you're probably not going to remember anything you learned in science class about science. So if you don't remember anything else, you remember this. Every morning I get up and I go to the bathroom. I throw water in my face and put the shaving cream on, and I shave. And I splash the cream off and I dry my face, and I look in that mirror and I say, 'Vernon, you're beautiful.'" He said, "You remember that." He said, "You'll go a long way if you remember that. Everybody wants to believe they're beautiful." And I have, as you see. So, whatever your politics are, I can tell you, in my experience, the overwhelming majority of the people I've worked with in politics are honest. And there's a lot of hysterical media coverage there about politics, particularly there was when I was there. When I think things have sobered up since 9/11. People thought there were no consequences before then to whatever they did or said. But I think it's important for you to know. I sat with Bob Dole. He came to see me not long after the 96 election. And I just asked him, I said, "You know, you've been here a lot longer than I have. Let me ask you something. Do you think politics is more or less honest in Washington today than it was 30 years ago?" He said, "Oh, it's not close. It's much, much more honest today." And I said, "Do you think the people believe it's more or less honest?" He said, "It's not close. They think it's less honest." So there's a disconnect there. Most people I know, if you don't support President Bush, if you go back and read what he said in the campaign, he's just doing what he said he'd do. And you've got to give him credit for that. You don't have to say he's a bad person. If you don't support him, you should say, I think he's wrong, and here's why. And if you do support him, you should say, not that those of us who don't are bad people, but you think we're wrong, and say why. Because this is a great enterprise, and no one has the whole truth. We're struggling to create a new reality for a new era. In the end of the book, I try to say how I think my philosophy should operate in the post-9/11 world. And I won't go through all that. I don't spend much time doing it. But it's worth looking at because it's a logical question to ask. But I would just say this. I'm all for whatever we can do to eradicate the Al-Qaeda and other terrorist networks. The president said tomorrow he wanted to double or triple or quadruple our troop presence in Afghanistan. I would cheer. But I think it's important that we do this in a way that doesn't compromise the character of our country or undermine the future of our children. And, you know, and I don't know that I'm blameless in this. Before the Patriot Act, and yeah, I agree with you. I think this book deal's nuts. I think, you know, who cares what people are reading? I think that should be changed. I agree with that. But to be fair, before the Patriot Act, before President Bush was president, when I was president, we had a law in the books that was perfectly understandable, given the terrorist threat. And I cared about it. Which simply said that if we have a suspected terrorist that we can arrest, we have enough to arrest this person. But in order to obtain a conviction, we would have to produce evidence in the person, you know, with a witness that would blow our entire intelligence network and might put more lives at risk. We could just keep them in prison indefinitely. And, you know, it sounds totally rational when you think about what we've suffered in New York on 9/11. But what if we make a mistake? And some poor sucker's just wasting away in jail. And that happened on my watch. So I don't think these are new and very difficult questions. But I think that we ought to begin by saying that free speech, including access to written materials and digital materials and all that, we need to bend over backwards to protect that, because if we all accept certain limits on our liberty. I can remember when there were no airport metal detectors. And I've never walked through one that I wasn't happy to do it. Have you? I like that. I used to argue with the NRA all the time. You know, there's a lot of hilarious stuff in here about my fights with the NRA. But their position was we should have the one area of our life in which we should have no prevention is in the gun area. If anybody does anything wrong with a gun, slap them with another 5 years or 10 years on their sentence. And that's all we need to do. And I said, just think if we took that in every other area. We just get rid of seat belts and airbags and let people drive 100 miles an hour, and then every time somebody kills somebody else in a plane and in a car crash, we just put 5 years on their sentence. Get rid of the airport metal detectors, and every time somebody blew up a plane, we take their remains and sentence them to 10 more years in the prison. But the point is, we all accept these things, and yet we have a new and different threat. The fundamental problem is that we're in an interdependent world where all the benefits that we get, right? You can get on the internet. I got a cousin in the mountains in North Arkansas, plays chess with a guy in Australia once a week. They take turns deciding who has to stay up late. And I wrote this book. Justin and I were talking about over here. It would have taken me another year to write this book if it hadn't been for the internet and how quickly we could retrieve materials. But you can't claim all the benefits of an open world without facing the fact that there are risks associated. The people that murdered all those folks in New York and Pennsylvania and the Pentagon, they used the interdependent society. They used open borders, easy travel, easy immigration, easy access to information and technology to kill all those people. So it's going to take us a while to get the right balance here to figure out how we're going to defend ourselves against this. That's another thing you shouldn't be pessimistic about. No terrorist effort has ever sunk any nation alone. And throughout history, every offensive weapons system or technique has always had a period when it prevailed until adequate defenses were developed. First time a person took a stick and made a spear out of it, or wrapped a stone around a stick and made an axe out of it, it worked like crazy until somebody else figured out how to put two sticks together, put an animal sitting across it, and then you'd have a shield, and it didn't work anymore. When knights got on horses, they could do real well against people that weren't on horses until they figured out how to build castles with moats around them, and then the horses couldn't get there. Then they figured out how to put a catapult together and get over the castle walls, and then somebody figured out a defense. It's gone on from time immemorial. So we're in the process. This thing about the Patriot Act in the books that a lot of you don't like, you should see it. You should oppose anything you don't like about it. This is America. We should have these free debates. And in this case, I think you're right. Nearly as I can tell, they haven't, at least the government hadn't made a case that I've seen for it yet. But on the other hand, you have to recognize also, we're just trying to figure this out. This is a new period, and we're struggling to come up with the defenses. It's part of the transition we're going through. New security threats and new defenses, and how to do it without compromising the character that made this country special and compromising the freedom and liberty that we want to leave to our children and our grandchildren. So that's the last point I want to make. The day I left the White House, after all I had been through, I was more optimistic than I was the day I got there. I had more confidence in the ability of free people to meet any challenge, to overcome any obstacle. And I believe now we've reached a point where the main thing is, nobody's going to be right all the time. The main thing about politics is going in the right direction and helping more people than you hurt. And we've now reached the point where we can't afford to have a politics that believes that our differences matter more than our common humanity. In 2000, Tony Blair joined me by satellite, and we announced that the International Consortium that had been working for years on this had succeeded in sequencing the human genome. Lots of fascinating things about it. We've already identified the variances that are most likely to cause breast cancer. We're very close on Parkinson's and Alzheimer's. It's going to be a wonder. But the most important thing to me about unpacking the mystery of the gene is that the scientists discovered that genetically we are all over 99.9% the same. And that if you take one racial or ethnic group and compare it to another, the group profiles have more similarities than individuals within the group do among themselves. And you just think about all the blood that's been spilled and all the stupid things that have been done and all the time and energy that has been wasted and all the heartbreak that today you see in the Middle East and elsewhere over less than 0.1% of human difference. That is the single great challenge. Do I think we should defend and fight terror? You bet I do. And I've already said, the President said tomorrow I'm going to send 100,000 troops to Afghanistan. I'd be out there on the front line saying, go get them. But we have to build a world with more partners and fewer terrorists, too. And we have to learn to cooperate in ways we never had. And we have to do it in a way that doesn't require us to give up our identity, our racial, our religious, our national identities, but enables us to subsume those, to enjoy our differences in a world where we're safe because our common humanity matters more. That is basically, I think, the great work of the 21st century. And that's sort of where I came at the end of my journey and what I try to do now that I'm out of office. Anyway, it is true, as Sonny said, when I was a boy, or a young man getting out of law school, I said that one of the goals I had in life was to write a great book. I have no earthly idea if this is a great book, but it's a pretty good story. Thank you very much.
Well, that was it, ladies and gentlemen, the 42nd President of the United States, Bill Clinton, and I think you probably miss him as much as I do. You know, to hear someone with that breadth of knowledge, with that discussion of history, someone who doesn't have to read from a teleprompter like our current president, but can just tell a story. You know, it made me proud to be a Southerner again, frankly, that this whole storytelling way. And he could do it with humor and humility. One point he said, my small life. You know, I still today, anytime I hear on the radio the song Don't Stop Thinking About Tomorrow, it practically brings tears to my eyes. I think about Bill Clinton, and I think about the optimism when he was elected and the hope. You know, it's a safety. It's a safeness. When he was president, I felt safe. I felt safe. And, you know, his it still has optimism. He's telling us it happened before. It'll be okay. It just reminded me of when I saw him right after 9/11, and he was the first on the scene, and people just crying, just holding people crying in his arms. That was the kind of president we used to have, folks. We forget the kind of president we used to have. If you want to call in and comment on Bill Clinton's speech, do so. It's 877-57-SCOOP. There's a number of things that I want to comment on. I was really touched by his discussion of Arkansas. He said, since nobody had any money, as long as you had clothes on your back, a place to sleep, and enough food to feed any person that walked into the door, you were respected. And he talked about learning to listen to the wisdom of superficially ordinary people. Now, that's something that I don't think our president has ever learned to do. It's something that, you know, when they say Bill Clinton felt each other's pain, felt our pain, he really did. He really knew. He talked about his town being poor white and poor black, where the person pumping your gas was just as smart as the person taking out your tonsils. And the only reason the person taking out your tonsils was where he was, or actually would have been a he in those days, was because of accidents of birth and circumstance. He was taught at a young age to look up to people that other folks look down on. Wouldn't it be great to have a president again who did that? There was a number of very, very powerful things he said that I really think resonate. He said that the 1960s, that those who think that it was more harm than good are probably Republicans today, and those who think it was more good was done than harm are probably Democrats. And maybe the best line he gave was that politics is not religion. We should govern on the basis of evidence, not theology. It doesn't detract from your religion to believe in something, but we should govern on the basis of evidence, not theology. He also talked about the fact that we shouldn't say someone so much is good or bad, but whether they're right or wrong. I always felt the Republicans that say, oh, liberals hate George W. Bush. It's not about hatred. I mean, we may hate the way the Supreme Court stole the election. We may hate the way that that kind of behavior is a threat to our Constitution, a threat to democracy. But I, for one, don't hate George W. Bush. I just think he's profoundly wrong. And Bill Clinton advises us that that is the language we need to use, because that is the language that attracts the middle. That is the language. To call George W. Bush evil, it's beside the point. It's beside the point. The point is he's a bad leader and he's wrong. And that's the kind of stuff we need to say to convince middle America to get rid of him. Look, the difference, I guess, again, Bill Clinton, hearing his humility, he talked about our founders wanting a more perfect union. They never said a perfect union. Never. Never. It's only our current president that seems to think he makes no mistakes. And just his knowledge of history, going through these constitutional moments in American history, back with the founders and Thomas Jefferson and the fights he had with Adams and our fight over slavery, all the while recognizing the reverence for our Constitution. And I thought it was very wise what he said about the turn of the century and the era of Teddy Roosevelt and Woodrow Wilson, when really the question was, since we had all this new big industry, should we have a big government to counteract that force of big industry? And it's striking to me, because I debate conservatives all the time. I do it as part of my job. I debate members of the Bush administration. And they go back to the founders and they say, you know, back in 1800, we had a very small government. Back in 1840, we didn't have income taxes. And the answer is, that's true. But it's also true that we didn't have big industry. We didn't have oil companies that control everyone in California like Enron did, where they can make jokes and manipulate electricity prices and make, you know, millions of people lose billions of dollars with a flick of the switch. They didn't have that in 1840 either. And so why do we need big government? Precisely to combat big industry. You never hear Republicans say, oh, well, I'm against Walmart. You know, I'm against monopolies. You never hear them say that. I'm against big oil companies. So, you know, we can't go back 200 years. If we didn't have the big industry, maybe we wouldn't need the big government. But we do have the big industry. And again, Bill Clinton reminded us of that. Ronald Reagan said government is the problem. Bill Clinton understood that government could be the solution. Sometimes it's the problem, but it could be the solution. And he talked about really the bipartisan consensus that was coming around 2000. You have to remember, most of the people that voted for George W. Bush believed his rhetoric. They thought he was actually a compassionate conservative. So, you know, don't dislike your fellow Americans for being hoodwinked by this guy, all right? He said he was a compassionate conservative. He acted like, Al Gore, right? Bush claimed to be compassionate. You can't really blame the Americans that voted for him for not knowing that he was lying, that he was actually going to move the country far to the right. And I think that Bill Clinton gives us a way to bring this country together. 9/11, Bill Clinton pointed out, where our unity was taken for weakness. 9/11, the country did come together. I remember being here in Washington, D.C. I remember when members of both parties came out in the Capitol steps, came out in public when George Bush was still hiding and sang God Bless America together. I mean, there was a time when we very much came together, and Republicans used that time and used the high opinion polls for Americans that were just looking for some kind of protection and leadership from our president. So, sure, they liked the president. They liked anyone that would fight against 9/11, and they used that to say, aha, they support our radical conservative agenda, which Americans didn't, and to move the country to the right. And, of course, Bill Clinton pointed out the difference between their agenda and ours. Our agenda, Bill Clinton's agenda, the Democratic agenda, is act together if we can and on our own if we have to. The Republican agenda, act on our own if we can and together if we have to. And there's a real difference in those philosophies. Don't pretend those two are the same. There's a real difference in those philosophies. And, as Bill Clinton said, our side will win because it works better, because it makes us more unified and inclusive. George W. Bush had to actually take our rhetoric. He claimed to be a uniter, not a divider. He claimed to reach out across the aisle. He talked about bipartisanness in Texas. People didn't know he would run such a partisan campaign. But the Democrats really are reaching out. And Bill Clinton points out that we have to understand why an opponent of ours thinks the way they do. And that's also, I think, very good advice. You know, I've had a number of Republicans on my show. Every now and then I get criticized for allowing them on my platform. But I think it's important for everyone, particularly those of us in the blue states, right, us liberals, us three free thinkers, to understand how the other side thinks. We should know how they think, if only to help persuade others that they're wrong. That they're wrong. As Bill Clinton, in his story, said Vernon was beautiful. He told himself he was beautiful. Everyone wants to believe they're beautiful. And Republicans want to believe that they have a beautiful agenda. And so we have to go through piece by piece, fact by fact, call them on it. When they try to avoid the question, say, now, wait a minute. Okay, very interesting, but you haven't answered my question. Okay, you like to talk about Bill Clinton's sex life. All right, fine. Are you done now? Now answer my question. Are we better off than we were 4 years ago? Are we better off compromising American values to put people in jail without trial? Is that American values? It's against our Bill of Rights. What, as Bill Clinton said, what if we made a mistake? I mean, I'm all for fighting terrorism against true terrorists. I have no problem with the death penalty. Maybe some of you do. I don't have a problem with the death penalty for Osama bin Laden, for people who are clearly terrorists. People have killed thousands of people. But what if we're wrong? The problem is not that I don't want to fight terrorists. The problem is that it's only by keeping American values can we make sure that we're not wrong. The Red Cross tells us that 70-90% of the Iraqis in Abu Ghraib prison were innocent, did nothing, never harmed Americans. And we tortured them. And now we find out that it goes to the very top, that it goes to the very top, that this came out of memos of the Bush administration. I'm going to be talking about this completely on Sunday. I hope you'll tune in for that at 7 Eastern Time. But we're going to talk about how it went to the very top. The heart of Bill Clinton's message, I think, is that do we help people more or hurt people more? It's about bringing our country together. And that's the kind of leader we used to have. It's the kind of country we can have again. I'm not against rich people. John Kerry is a very fortunate person, but he, like the Kennedys, who had plenty of wealth, they understand that America is more than the wealthy. They understand. I mean, John Kerry joining and fighting in Vietnam, the Kennedys, they care the way Bill Clinton does about a poor black woman, right, in the ghetto, the person that George Bush couldn't care about. And that, my friends, is the difference and why I miss Bill Clinton. Hope you'll tune in tomorrow. We've got a very different kind of show, not so serious perhaps. Well, it's a serious issue to me to some extent. I want to talk about an issue that isn't really conservative or liberal. It's an issue of, clean air. And that is, should you be able to smoke in public places? And it's one where I want to hear from you. I want to know your views on it. Tune in tomorrow at 3 p.m. Eastern for another edition of The Inside Scoop. This is Mark Levine signing off. Thank you for listening to this very special, unedited broadcast featuring the person who I believe was the best president in my lifetime.